From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Saddam Hussein runs a brutal repressive regime, but according to the human rights group Middle East Watch, several of the U.S. allies in the Gulf are violating human rights under the cloak of combating the Iraqi occupation of Kuwait. On today's Fresh Air, the human rights implications of the Gulf crisis. If the U.S. and Iraq go to war, part of what we'll be fighting over is oil. Coming up, an analysis of oil politics in the Gulf from energy analyst Daniel Yergin. Also, we talk with a guardsman from Harlem about to ship out for the Gulf, where his wife is already serving. They're leaving behind a 7-year-old son. And we'll hear from a Georgia mother whose 3 sons have all been called to serve. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Talks over a proposed UN Security Council resolution on Israel's occupied territories are continuing tonight, but there are increasing signs of friction among council members. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports.
The UN's ambassador to Malaysia, Ismail Razali, told reporters tonight that talks over the resolution had broken down, but that was quickly denied by U.S. officials. This exchange came following several days of tough negotiations over the resolution, which attempts to broaden UN participation in the Arab-Israeli peace process. The U.S. is said to object to a clause referring to a proposed international peace conference to address the Middle East, something Israel objects to. U.S. officials have been trying to modify the resolution, but the 4 non-aligned countries on the council say the measure is already watered down enough. If the 4 sponsors choose to, they could force a vote on this measure tonight. That could force the U.S. to veto it. But American officials are still trying to avoid such a move, which would anger Arab allies and strain the anti-Iraq coalition that has been built up over the past few months. In New York, this is Jim Zeroli reporting.
The U.S. announced today that it will withdraw its diplomats from the embassy in Kuwait City after they finished helping with the evacuation of American hostages. The U.S. mission in Kuwait has been operating with a skeleton staff, cut off from electricity and water and besieged by Iraqi soldiers. The State Department stressed that the embassy is not being closed. Spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler said the U.S. expects the Iraqi occupation forces to respect the embassy premises, which would be restaffed at a later date. Iraq turned back a British Airways jet bound for Baghdad today, which was on its way to pick up freed British nationals. NPR's Jackie Lydon reports.
The British Airways Boeing 767 took off from Heathrow Airport in London today to pick up stranded British citizens, but it never made it further than Amman, Jordan. Iraqi officials say they telexed British Airways authorities in London to say that the plane would not be allowed to land, but BA officials say they never received any such telex. The plane was carrying 400 bottles of champagne for a freedom party, food, and medicine. British Airways said they'd try sending the plane in again tomorrow after going through diplomatic sources to begin evacuating about 1,600 British citizens in Iraq and Kuwait. Iraqi Airways says it wants to operate all hostage airlifts. Such airlifts would provide a lot of hard foreign currency for Baghdad. I'm Jackie Lydon in Amman.
Stock prices slipped again on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than 12 points to close at 2,590. Overall, the index gained almost 31 points this week. Losing issues barely edged advances in moderate trading of 165 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Iraq's occupation of Kuwait has made Americans aware of Saddam Hussein's miserable record of human rights abuses. As the executive director of the human rights group Middle East Watch, Andrew Whitley is examining all the human rights implications of the Gulf crisis, monitoring abuses not only in Iraq and occupied Kuwait, but also in the countries that the U.S. is allied with. Middle East Watch is a division of Human Rights Watch, which monitors violations around the world. Yale University Press has just issued their report on human rights in Iraq. Whitley told me that Iraq is the most repressive country in the region.
There is no individual freedom in Iraq. It is impossible for an individual to be able to form an association of his own, to be able to express a political opinion of his own without being arrested. There is a massive personality cult for President Saddam Hussein, of which all citizens are expected to participate in. There has been severe repression of the many ethnic minorities in the country, notably the very large Kurdish minority, but also some smaller groups, the Turkoman, the Assyrians, Assyrians are Christians, and other, the Shia minority in the country. I think that the country has behaved under President Saddam Hussein as if it was a personal fiefdom for the ruler. He has been able to repress people whenever he chooses to do so. I think there have been some of the most egregious examples of dissent in which the president has simply gone out and in one case shot a cabinet member in an adjoining room.
Saddam Hussein used chemical weapons against the Kurds in Iraq. I think the history of how Iraq's boundaries were drawn can help explain how Kurds became the hated outsiders in their own country. Could you give us some historical background on that?
Yes, the Kurds are a very unfortunate group of people who inhabit the region that is presently comprised by parts of Turkey, Iran, Iraq, Syria, a little bit of Lebanon, even a little bit of the Soviet Union. They inhabit this contiguous area of territory. There are probably some 25 million Kurds throughout the region. And in their own homeland, they have been seeking for some years, not independence, but autonomy and recognition of Kurdish culture and independent society in order to be able to preserve their own language. And in Iraq, the government has alternated between repressing them very fiercely sometimes in a series of campaigns over the years, or else of occasionally entering into negotiations trying to split the various Kurdish parties. But you rightly refer to the gas attacks which took place in 1988, both before the end of the Iran-Iraq war, which ended in August of 1988, and immediately in its aftermath. As soon as the ceasefire was signed with Iran, President Saddam Hussein sent his armies into Kurdistan, into the Iraqi region of Kurdistan, in order to be able to launch a really massive attack. And subsequently, some 500,000 villagers have been forced to be depopulated from their areas, relocating them into camps which could perhaps best be described as detention camps.
Let's compare Iraq's human rights record with the human rights record of our allies in the Middle East. There's a new Human Rights Watch newsletter, and in that you write, under the cloak of combating Iraqi occupation, some of the actions taken by U.S. allies are extremely troubling. Can you elaborate on that?
Yes, we can. We believe that in a number of the areas that where there are U.S. forces or where allies have been taking place, that there have been a number of abuses which are not being spotlighted at this particular time. Perhaps the best example is in Saudi Arabia, where the Saudis have, out of pique at the attitude of the government in Yemen to the south, have expelled or forced to flee from their country some 750,000 Yemenis. This is an enormous number of people out of about 2 million Yemenis who had been living in Saudi Arabia. Suddenly, overnight, their conditions of residence and their work permits were arbitrarily changed. They were not given the opportunities in order to be able to adjust their lifestyle to these new regulations in a sensible way. It was clearly a vindictive, punitive action. We were able to record many cases of beatings or of other harassment. Beyond that, I think that there have been actions in Turkey. Turkey not only is a NATO country, but a close U.S. ally. And in the Kurdish region of Turkey, adjoining Iraq, we have detected that there has been a stepping up of the actions of the Turkish army against Kurdish guerrillas in that region. And the way that they do it is going out to burn villages, forcing villagers either to join a government-sponsored village militia to combat these guerrillas. It's forced conscription, in effect. And if they don't join, then they burn their villages. We believe that there could be anything up to 200 villages, which in recent months, and in particular since the invasion, and it would be a reasonable conclusion to say that under the cloak of feeling that they can get away with it at this particular time because their military and political support is so important.
Let's get back to Saudi Arabia. The Yemenis in Saudi Arabia are being punished because of Yemen's support for Iraq?
That's correct, yes, indeed. I should have explained this more clearly, that the Yemeni government has taken a position towards the conflict and has traditionally had a political relationship with Iraq, which has been unpopular in Saudi Arabia. But I think also there is an additional factor here, which is that Yemen, since its reunification some 6 months ago, has moved ahead with a number of very interesting democratic reforms. They're putting into play political reforms to do with political pluralism, with the allowing of trade unions to be formed, a freedom of expression, a freedom of assembly, which is quite unheard of in this part of the world. And the example is a very potent one for the more repressive societies that surround them.
Can you expand on Saudi Arabia's human rights record?
Saudi Arabia's human rights record, as best we can tell, and that has been one of the most closed societies, and clearly one that we have not done very much first-hand work on yet. Our organization is about to publish a report on labor conditions in Saudi Arabia, and that will, in effect, say that labor rights are totally absent in a country which has been highly dependent on imported foreign labor, not just from the West, but also from many Asian countries. There have been perhaps as many as 5 million, 7 million foreign workers in the country, and they're granted no labor rights whatsoever. They can't form a union, they cannot strike. If they engage in any form of collective bargaining, then they're subject to expulsion from the country or even for jailing. But we wished to tread rather carefully when it comes to condemning practices which Saudi Arabia would say are sanctioned by Islamic belief, by the Quran and by the Sharia Islamic law, such as the beheading in public of offenders or of amputations. These actions are inscribed in the Quran, though we as a human rights organization clearly would find them abhorrent.
Well, that leads me to the question of women's rights. I mean, women have few rights in Saudi Arabia. I mean, there's a lot of things that we take for granted that women cannot do in Saudi Arabia. People in Saudi Arabia, I think, would offer a religious explanation for that. And I wonder what Human Rights Watch position on that is. At what point is the abridgment of women's rights a religious issue, and at what point is it a human rights issue?
We believe that the religious justification, which is often used for the subordination of women, not just in Saudi Arabia but elsewhere in the Middle East, is often a pretext. There really is not the evidence there, if one examines the Hadith or the Quran, to be able to say that women ought to be forced to wear a veil, for example, or should not be allowed to drive. Although that argument is often put forward in Saudi Arabia in order to be able to ban women from driving, it patently is an absurdity, because it's not the case that they are not able to drive, and there is no prescription against it, or even in the most liberal of interpretations of the Quran. We think, therefore, that it's the pressure from the more conservative religious forces who represent a conservative attitude towards society as a whole, and that's what we ought to be attacking.
Will you be bringing up the subject of women's rights in the future?
We certainly will. Perhaps not in the first instance in Saudi Arabia. We wish to proceed incrementally and not in a way that is simply going to slam doors in our faces. We find it highly instructive that as a result of the Gulf crisis, that Saudi Arabia is permitting a mission from our organization to visit that country in January, and that work is going to be carried out by a woman.
The Kuwaiti government was deposed after the invasion by Iraq. Would you like to see the former Kuwaiti government reinstated? What was their human rights record like?
Their human rights record was not as bad as some of their neighbors, but it was not a particularly good one either. I think it certainly is worth pointing out and keeping in the forefront of public debate in the United States that while this country was an autocracy, it was ruled by an hereditary monarchy, that there was a degree of popular consent and a degree of popular support. On the other hand, this is a country that has a constitution. It was promulgated in 1962. And in 1986, under the pretext of the Gulf War, the Emir suspended that constitution. At the same time, he suspended many of the basic rights. He suspended parliament. He suspended freedom of press. And he was able to introduce a number of emergency powers which he would not have been able to get away with otherwise. We certainly as an organization feel that while we have no quarrel with the restoration of the legitimate government in the country, we don't enter into the politics of the matter, that we would like to see the pro-democracy movement, which was just beginning to gather a head of steam in Kuwait before the invasion and had been quite powerful in trying to force the emir into granting new elections. We would like to see that trend encouraged by the United States. It would be entirely appropriate that they should do so.
The United States has been debating whether the embargo against Iraq is effective, whether it would be effective in the future. What, from your perspective, what are the ethics of a blockade where civilians are being cut off from food supplies?
This is an extremely tricky issue, and one that we as an organization have debated among ourselves about. We certainly feel that causing unnecessary or undue suffering to civilians is something that should be avoided. And there are members of our organization, very distinguished moral theologians, for example, who will say that if one is faced with a choice of two evils, one of which would be the hardship of a number of innocent civilians, and the other would be to be the horrors of all-out warfare, that one should choose the lesser of the evils if it can be demonstrated that that is going to be a way to avoid the latter. On the other hand, when you're faced with a ruthless, repressive leader such as Saddam Hussein, who is in a position to be able to dictate where food supplies go to in that country, and he's made it quite clear that his first priority is the army, his second priority is military industries and other forces, and the poor foreign workers who are still stuck in the country make short shrift for themselves. They have been told they have to fend for themselves. Then, really, it becomes almost immaterial whether there is a food boycott or not, because he is going to be in a position simply to be able to keep his army sustained. And we have evidence that they are beginning to face some problems of feeding themselves in Kuwait at the moment.
Do you think that the West has been practicing a double standard on human rights, ignoring it when the culprits are your allies and opposing it when they're your enemies?
It's a very reasonable question, and I think that there is a lot of evidence for that. I think the actions of the State Department's Human Rights Bureau have not been particularly honorable in this case, certainly in recent years, when the evidence was clear-cut for all to see from the behavior of President Saddam Hussein, that they have not acted in order to be able to highlight those actions or to put Iraq in the dock where the U.S. had the opportunity to do so. And there is very much the danger that we will do the same thing again with Syria. Syria's record is almost as bad when it comes to the treatment of its own people or the treatment of Syrian troops, the behavior of Syrian troops in Lebanon towards the Lebanese people. And it's rather sad that President Bush has not taken the opportunity to at least bring up those issues of democracy and individual liberties in forging this alliance with President Assad.
Andrew Whitley, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Andrew Whitley is Executive Director of Middle East Watch. Their report, Human Rights in Iraq, has just been published by Yale University Press. Coming up, we talk with a sergeant in the Harlem Battalion of the National Guard who's about to be shipped off to the Gulf. This is Fresh Air. The U.S. commitment of troops to the Gulf has already affected hundreds of thousands of people's lives in ways they never really expected. Sergeant George Rowan is in a particularly unusual situation. Both he and his wife are in the National Guard. Her unit was sent to the Gulf in early November, and just this week he received notice that his unit was being activated and would probably be in the Gulf by Christmas. They're leaving behind a 7-year-old son. George Rowan is a retired New York City police officer who's a member of the 369th Transportation Battalion of the New York National Guard. During World War I, the battalion earned combat distinction and the name Harlem Hellfighters. I spoke with Sergeant Rowan today from a payphone at his post in the Armory in Harlem. I asked Rowan if there were any regulations about a husband and wife who were parents both being sent to the Gulf.
Well, the rule is, in order to be in the military, you must have someone designated as a guardian of your children. So, you know, the rule is that if both of us are in the military and both of us are scheduled to go to the Gulf, we both have to go. At this time,
I think that reduced the issue to the command.
At this time, I could possibly avoid going on the hardship conditions. In other words, the hardship would be that I would have no one to watch my 7-year-old son. Ultimately, since I'm full-time in the military, it would cause me to be discharged. So at this point, I have someone that can take care of my son. It's been pretty difficult for him to deal with it, but I have someone that could take care of my son. So I choose to go.
Who's going to take care of your son?
My mother-in-law, my wife's mother, is going to be looking after my son while both of us are away.
How's your son taking it?
Pardon me?
How is your son taking it, knowing that your both his parents are going to be gone?
He's not taking it too well. You know, he's not taking it too well. He spoke to me. I spoke to him about it when I got the call, and he says, well, now I don't have any family here. You know, and I had to explain to him that he had family here and that, you know, we would be back. He says, you know what I mean, Dad. He says, I don't have you and Mom. You know I have family, but I don't have you and Mom. And I explained to him that his mother would be back shortly and I would be back probably, you know, not too long after she got back.
What were your reasons and your wife's reasons for each joining the National Guard?
Well, I was in the Marine Corps on active duty, and I got out of the Marine Corps. I came into the National Guard, and I've been in the Guard some 21 years. My wife has been in the Guard for 15 years. And our reason for joining, I've been in the military basically all my life, and my wife joined as a young female, 17 years old, and she's been in the Guard basically all of her life. You know, this is our way of life. We like the military, we love the military, we love doing what we do, and this is the price that we have to pay. You know, we signed a contract, and we feel as though it's our obligation now to live up to that contract.
We're hearing a lot of chaos in the background right now. What's it like today at the 369th Armory?
Well, right now, we have the unit that's due to mobilize and leave here day after tomorrow, which would be Sunday. They just had a formation in the corridor here, and we had some people come in from the state to talk to them and wish them well on their trip to the Gulf, and Godspeed to bring them back. And the formation is just breaking up at this point.
Have you heard from your wife in the Gulf?
Yes, I did. I spoke to my wife Saturday last, and I spoke to her Monday past. Monday, I think, was around the 4th. But she has no idea now that I've been alerted and scheduled to mobilize.
She doesn't know yet?
We got our call Tuesday. So I haven't spoke to her since, you know, the call came in for us. I'm waiting for a call from her now to let her know, you know, what's going on here.
How do you think she's going to take it?
I think she's going to be really upset because she worries a lot about me and my son. And I think now that she knows, she when she finds out that I'm mobilized and that I'll be also coming to Saudi Arabia, I think she's going to basically be very, you know, upset because she's going to really be worried about, you know, my son.
Will you be able to see each other when you're both in the Gulf?
I have no idea. I have no idea what location in the Gulf I'm going to be at. And I have some idea where she's at, but I don't know in relationship to where I'm going to be at, how far it is and how long, you know, if I'm going to be able to see her. If any way possible, I will see her.
What are the benefits of being in the National Guard that have kept you in it for so long?
Well, the benefits in the National Guard is a long-term benefit. It's nothing that you can see in the short term. It's for when you actually get older and you're able to retire. You can get a retirement from the National Guard. Health benefits you get, you know, at age 60 for the rest of your life. You get a pension for the rest of your life. And you get a chance to make a little money, you know, weekend drills. That's for the part-timer. But like I said, myself, I'm full-time. I'm regular Army, per se, AGR, what they call AGR, Active Guard Reserve. But we have all the benefits of regular Army. And this is my job. I do this every day.
Can you tell us how you're preparing yourself mentally and physically for going to the Gulf?
Well, mentally I'm prepared. Mentally, physically, I'm prepared. Mentally, I know it's just something that I have to do. You know, I feel as though going to the Gulf is an obligation and that I will return. You know, that my family, my wife will return. I look on this as a temporary setback, and it's nothing that my family can't overcome. And this is what keeps me going. With this thought in mind, I'm able to, you know, do what I have to do. You know, mentally, I'm ready. Physically, I'm ready. You know, and that's about it.
How closely have you been following the news? And
very closely. I look at the news when every chance I get, from 7 o'clock in the morning till I leave my house, And when I get home at night from 6 o'clock in the evening till I go to bed. So I look at the news every day and I follow it.
Do you have an opinion about whether the situation is worthy of going to war for?
Different days, different, you know, opinions. I look at the news and sometimes it looks favorable. And other times, it looks like we're at a stalemate and something's going to happen. You know, I really don't know. We had some good news recently, you know, with the hostages. You know, and I was happy about that. I thought it was a very good sign. But then a day or two later, we find out that Saddam Hussein has moved 30,000 new troops into Kuwait and 200 more tanks, and that doesn't sound too good. You know, like I said, from day to day, my feelings towards it change.
Do you think that a war would be justified in the Gulf?
No, I don't.
But you're willing to go and fight in it anyway.
Well, I'm willing to go and fight in it because, like I said, I feel like it's my obligation. I signed this contract, and whether I realized or not that, the National Guards might someday be activated, mobilized, and sent to war, you know, you have to understand that when you sign your name on a contract, it's binding. And this is something that, you know, I feel that I have to do. It's not something that I feel that I want to do, and it's not something that I feel I might be justified in doing. But it's something that I have to do because my word and my signature is all that I have to go by at this point.
Is your son going to come and see you off?
No, he's not. He's not. I really don't think that I could take that. You know, my wife couldn't. You know, it was hard for her. And she actually didn't want to see either one of us see her off because prior to her leaving, she had a chance. She was at Fort Dix for 6 weeks prior to leaving. And she had a chance on the weekends to come home. And each time she came home and went back, it was harder for her. You know, and we did make it down to see her basically every weekend that she couldn't come home. We were there. But when she was getting ready to leave, she didn't, you know, really wish to see us at that point. We talked on the phone, but she said it would be very hard, and I understood that, you know. So I don't think I would want to see my son before I leave. When I leave him at home the day or day before I deploy to Fort Dix, you know, I just want to remember him there and leave. And I don't think that. I don't think I can take this interview anymore.
Sergeant Rowan, I really wish you the best, and I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, and good luck.
Bye.
Sergeant George Rowan spoke with us from the 369th Battalion Armory in Harlem. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. If Iraq succeeds in holding on to Kuwait, Saddam Hussein would control 25% of the world's oil reserves. Understanding oil politics is essential to understanding the Gulf crisis. Coming up, a talk with energy analyst Daniel Yergin, the author of A New History of Oil, Power, and Money. Also, we hear from one of the many mothers hoping for a peaceful resolution in the Gulf. Marie Burke has three sons, and they've all been called up for active duty in the National Guard. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The State Department says that the eight American diplomats who have defied Iraq by remaining in the U.S. Embassy in Kuwait will be pulled out once all Americans in Kuwait are set free. Barry Schweid has more from the State Department.
Ambassador Nathaniel Howell and his band of seven assistants have held out against a cutoff in food and electricity, defying, along with a handful of other governments, Iraq's demand they close the embassy and depart now that Kuwait has been annexed. Iraqi President Saddam Hussein's offer to free all Americans in Iraq and Kuwait has caused the Bush administration to change its stand. Margaret Tutwiler, the State Department spokeswoman, said the American diplomats were assisting Americans trapped in Kuwait. Their departure, she said, means the diplomats can go rather than remain under Iraqi guard. A U.N. Security Council resolution called on Iraq to resupply the embassy with food, water, and electricity. That has become academic. The embassy won't close, but there will be no Americans there. Spokeswoman Tutwiler said American diplomats would return to Kuwait when the overthrown Kuwaiti government is restored to power. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schweid at the State Department.
In Iraq, the parliament there has approved a plan by Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein to let thousands of hostages go home. Officials say those people stranded since the August invasion of Kuwait may leave starting tomorrow. However, a British airplane was not allowed to land in Baghdad because officials say the hostages will be flown on Iraqi flights to Jordan. U.S. officials say that Iraq has sent 30,000 more troops to Kuwait and southern Iraq in recent days. The Israeli army has imposed widespread curfews in the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip in an effort to prevent disturbances as the third anniversary of the Palestinian uprising approaches. Patricia Golan reports.
Saturday marks 2 months since at least 17 Palestinians were killed by Israeli police at the Muslim holy places in Jerusalem. Sunday is the third anniversary of the Intifada. The army is taking no chances. To try to keep a lid on the expected clashes, the army has already placed main Palestinian centers in the West Bank and Gaza under strict curfew until Monday morning. Major cities and almost all refugee camps have been affected, either placed under curfew or declared closed military areas. Since October, the incidents of violence and ferocity of the Intifada have increased. The underground leadership of the uprising has called for Palestinians to escalate the struggle using any weapons available against soldiers and Jewish settlers. The army has reported a sharp increase in the use of firearms. For National Public Radio, this is Patricia Golan in Jerusalem.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 12 points to close at 2,590.10. on volume of almost 165 million shares. Declining issues led advances by only a slight margin in active trading. This is NPR News.
After Iraq invaded Kuwait, President George Bush said our jobs, our own freedom, and the freedom of friendly countries around the world would all suffer if control of the world's great oil reserves fell into the hands of Saddam Hussein. Oil was behind Iraq's invasion of Kuwait, and oil is one of the reasons there will soon be 400,000 U.S. troops in Saudi Arabia. My guest Daniel Yergin has written a history of oil politics and oil money called The Prize. Yergin is also co-author of the bestseller Energy Future, a report of the energy project at the Harvard Business School, and Shattered Peace, a history of the origins of the Cold War. He's president of the international consulting firm Cambridge Energy Research Associates. Daniel Yergin says the current tensions in the Gulf have their origins in the period after World War I, when the colonial powers carved out new countries and new borders in the Middle East.
There was an acute need to redraw the map because the Ottoman Empire, rickety as it was, finally collapsed with the First World War. And there's a big question of what was going to become of these various territories. And of course, it was a time when the notion of nation states and nationalism had become much more powerful. And so the Middle East was divided into a series of different states. Some of it was quite arbitrary. What is called modern Iraq was really three rather disparate provinces, eastern provinces of the Turkish Empire, that had very little to do with each other, and yet there was a strong effort to create and forge a nation and to create something called Iraqi nationalism. Now, one of the factors involved in the drawing of the map was oil. It wasn't the only factor by any means, but coming out of the First World War, where oil had played a larger role than anybody had expected, countries were really focused on oil as a strategic resource as we see it today. I mean, the people had gone to war thinking it would be a war of trains and a war with horses, and it turned out to be a motorized battlefield. And there had been a shortage in the latter part of the war. So Britain in particular was very keen to, among other things, ensure itself some kind of access to oil supplies so it wouldn't be vulnerable in the future. And it looked to do so in the mandate of what became Iraq. And so there was a squabble between the French and the British over the boundaries and of creating Syria and creating Iraq. But in the current context, it's interesting that to see and read mistakes of history as this Gulf crisis now unfolds before our eyes, because people say the boundaries of Kuwait were drawn, as I read in one recent magazine article, with the whiff of oil in the air. There was an expectation there would be oil in the northern part of Iraq, near where, really in the area where the Kurds live. But it was the general view was that there was not going to be oil in Kuwait or Saudi Arabia. All the best geologists said that there was not any prospect of oil there. And there was really one besotted New Zealander, a major in the British Army during the war, who was convinced that there was, and he promoted the oil over a period of 10 years.
You say that the Gulf became especially important for oil when Russia, which is a very large supplier of oil, was closed off by the revolution.
Yes, well, then both, you know, most people don't know this, but that the Russian oil industry was dominated by two families, the Rothschilds from Paris and the Nobel families from Stockholm. And they, in the Russian oil industry, was, along with the United States, the major world source for petroleum up until the First World War. Then came the Bolshevik Revolution and, of course, the Civil War and then the nationalization. And Standard Oil of New Jersey and Royal Dutch Shell bought out the interests of the Nobels and the Rothschild family and thought that, well, the Bolsheviks would be cleared in 6 months. They weren't cleared in 6 months. It took 70 years, as we've seen in the last year, for that to happen. But the loss of Russian oil, which had been such an important source, combined with the experience of World War I, gave a great impetus to what was called the global oil hunt. And for instance, the U.S. State Department really pushed the American companies to go overseas and seek new sources of oil because of this feared shortage. For instance, that's why Venezuela was opened up. But the really interesting thing is that except for this New Zealander, Major Holmes, who had heard about oil while he was buying beef in Addis Ababa in Ethiopia, nobody thought that there would be oil in Kuwait or Saudi Arabia. And it was considered wildcatting on a colossal scale.
Well, it wasn't until 1935 that Kuwait actually became an oil-producing country.
Yeah, actually, it was the oil concession for Kuwait was finally granted at the end of 1934 to a joint venture of Gulf Oil and what became British Petroleum. But it took another 3 years, really, in fact, until February 1938 when the real discovery was made. And it was this. A month later, a discovery was made in Saudi Arabia, and people started to realize that there was a constellation of oil fields and of resources of the sort that had never been seen anywhere else in the world.
Let's get back to a minute to something we were talking about a little earlier. Let's get back to how the map was redrawn after the First World War in the Middle East. You described how the boundaries of Iraq were formed. What about Saudi Arabia, which is one of our allies in the Gulf crisis now, another key player in all of oil politics?
Saudi Arabia was a different thing. It had been a second restoration of the Al Saud family had occurred as a result of a warrior king, Ibn Saud, the the father of the present king, in fact, the father of the last several kings, who fathered about 40 children, 40 sons altogether, who had started off in 1902 to retake the family kingdom, which they had been thrown out and were living in exile in Kuwait. And with the backing of the Al-Sabah family, Ibn Saud set off on a program of conquest to regain Arabia. And by the 1920s, he had regained just about all of it, of what is modern Saudi Arabia. He had battled the family of the present King Hussein of Jordan. And that, by the way, that old battle, that ancient battle, comes up in the present discussions of the Gulf, where for a time there was a suspicion that Saddam Hussein had promised King Hussein of Jordan that he could get Saudi Arabia back and be put back as King of Saudi Arabia by a victorious Iraq. This was a kind of rumors that were floating around. So these ancient battles that seem long ago actually have very current and significance. But Ibn Saud reestablished the kingdom. It was very much a stern, fundamentalist Islamic state, very much closed off to the outside world. But Ibn Saud ran into a financial problem. The country's main source of revenues were the pilgrims who came to Mecca as part of their religion. And with the Great Depression of the early 1930s, of course, the pilgrimage collapsed because people just didn't have the money to come. And Ibn Saud really was in a desperate state. He needed money. He needed money not only for a modernization program he had embarked on in his kingdom and radio systems and importing cars and so forth, but he needed money to subsidize all these different tribes which he had tied to himself both through intermarriage and also through by providing them with subsidies. And he had a British advisor, a sort of renegade Englishman, some called him an arch humbug, Sijan Philby, who was the father of the famous British spy Kim Philby, who spied on behalf of the Soviet Union. And Sijan Philby told this despondent king that there was the possibility of buried treasure in his kingdom. And Ibn Saud didn't think there was oil, but he thought he would like to have people come and spend money looking for oil because he would get the revenues and they would leave and his kingdom wouldn't be upset. What he actually hoped they would find was water. They didn't find water, but Chevron, as it's now called, geologists from Standard Oil of New Jersey and lawyers, showed up willing to wildcat in Saudi Arabia because oil had been discovered on the neighboring island of Bahrain. And after a long negotiation in which Sijan Philby, or Jack Philby as he was known, or as Ibn Saud called him, Abdullah Philby after his conversion to Islam, played a role of a triple spy, just like his son was a double spy, and but really acted as a sorcerer's apprentice, bringing Standard Oil of California into Saudi Arabia and launching them on the exploration that would change the world of oil and change much else in the world as well.
When oil companies from Europe and America started looking for oil in the Middle East, what were the relationships like early on between the oil companies and the country that the oil wells were located in?
The companies tended to be enclaves of the modern world in the middle of traditional societies. They had concessions, which meant that they would own the oil that they would discover. The companies were usually the targets of criticism from either local nationalists or fundamentalists. The companies thought they were taking great risk and were providing a service by creating wealth where there wasn't any in the country. But there was always constant tension right from the beginning between the countries and the companies over who would get the proceeds and the real benefits of the oil that might be discovered.
What kind of monetary deals were negotiated? What percentage went to the oil company? What percentage was kept by the country?
Companies would pay a royalty, 4 shillings, or they'd pay in gold sovereigns, for instance, Iran would get 20% of the global profits of Anglo-Persian, as British Petroleum was called. But the whole history from that period up until to the present day was where it started where the companies would get the benefits, the primary benefits, and as time would go on, the countries would assert more say and more control. In the late 1940s, in the early 50s, you had the 50-50, where the profits would really be split down the middle. And then by the 1970s, most of the profit was going to the country because it held the high card in the nationalist era, and the companies were becoming more like contractors until they were nationalized altogether. So it moved along a spectrum over a 40-year period.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. And my guest is Daniel Yergin. He's the author of the new book, The Prize, The Epic Quest for Oil, Money, and Power. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Daniel Yergin. He's the president of Cambridge Energy Research Associates, an international energy consulting firm. And he's the author of the new book, The Prize, The Epic Quest for Oil, Money, and Power. From the perspective of oil, what did Saddam Hussein have to gain from invading Kuwait?
From the perspective of oil, what he had to gain was money and power. That he would have, I can't say with a stroke of a pen, but with the movement of his tanks, he would have doubled the oil resources of Iraq, made it an oil superpower almost the equal of Saudi Arabia. He would have had, with double the revenues, could have pursued a much more, even much bigger program of building up arms and weaponry and turning Iraq into a kind of a mini superpower. So the prize indeed for him, if he had pulled this off, was quite enormous and would have really changed the balance in the world. It's interesting, this whole episode started with two surprises. One was that Saddam Hussein had 100,000 troops on the border of Kuwait, and no one, including the Kuwaitis, thought they'd be used. The second surprise, and that was a surprise to us, the second surprise was this international coalition that President Bush put together. And I am sure, as you must be sure, that if Saddam Hussein had sat back and thought, my God, we're going to be quarantined like this, we're not going to get any hard currency revenues, instead of getting richer, we might get poorer, and I might even lose my job, that he would have certainly thought twice. He thought it was going to be a cakewalk.
Do you think that Saddam Hussein has any historical claim to the oil fields that he wants to get from Kuwait and the offshore islands?
Well, I think that the oil field, it's a contentious question. The Kuwaitis were taking what is a relatively minor amount of production out of it. I think the structure of an oil industry, the structure of an oil reservoir is a complex thing to map, and you need to get this sort of oil engineers on both sides, the petroleum engineers, to get together and have some common reference to say, well, really, where is this oil? Where is it migrated? And as I understand, that hasn't been done. As to the islands, they had historically been Kuwaiti. But they were, you know, of strategic significance to Iraq, which has a relatively small seacoast, and so that from a strategic point of view, if Iraq could grab them, it would be to Iraq's advantage. The Kuwaitis didn't feel like giving up the territory. Maybe in retrospect, they would have. The ironic thing in this whole imbroglio is that Iraq was getting a lot of its objectives. In any event, in June and July, the wind was blowing from Baghdad and the other countries were falling in line. Oil prices were going up and Iraq was becoming known as the enforcer in OPEC. And people were really scared of Iraq. And he probably could have gotten that island and the oil field, whatever the merits of the thing, if he had just kept the pressure up. And the rest of the world would never have learned to spell either the name of the island or of the oil field.
A lot of our involvement in the Gulf has to do with oil. What if Iraq invaded Kuwait and nobody did anything and things just played out from there? What effect do you think that would have had on oil?
Well, there was one theory, the saying, well, he'd want to sell his oil anyway, and therefore it really wouldn't matter at all. I take a different view. I think it would have really changed the balance of power, and I think the other countries would have fallen in line, and Iraq and Saddam Hussein would dominate much of the world's oil, and use that to move on to positions of even greater power and influence. I mean, I don't think he was invading Kuwait just so he could be our larger oil merchant.
It must be very hard to predict the oil energy future right now. There's not only the Gulf crisis, but there's a lot of upheaval in the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union is one of the largest oil producers in the world.
The largest.
Okay, so and with the possibility of some of their republics seceding, I guess who can predict what the Soviet Union's oil future is going to be?
You know, it's one of these ironies of history are so, in a sense, delicious and interesting that 30 years ago, one of the great fears in Washington was of a Soviet oil exports going up and a Soviet economic offensive exporting more oil and gaining political power. Now we'd be delighted to see the Soviet Union, or whatever it's going to be called in 5 years, exporting more oil. And we see the Soviet Union as the counterbalance to excessive dependence on the Persian Gulf. But in the meantime, of course, the Soviet Union is in chaos and disintegration, and Soviet oil production and exports are going down. And yet, looking towards the end of the 1990s, if you did a poll of oil companies, you said, where do you want to be at the end of the 1990s? What oil play do you want to be in? They'd say, the best bet around, one of the best bets around is the Soviet Union, and we hope we'll be able to be exploring there. And the Soviets, whose own oil industry is in a deplorable condition, are actively wooing these capitalist companies to come in and spend money and apply their technology. So history really does get turned around.
I want to thank you a lot for talking with us about oil. Thank you.
Thank you.
And my guest has been Daniel Yergin, and he's the president of Cambridge Energy Research Associates, which is an international energy consulting firm. He's the author of a new history of oil, and it's called The Prize, The Epic Quest for Oil, Money, and Power. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer is with us. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. Today we will be watching the United Nations debate on a resolution to have a Middle East peace conference. The United States has always opposed that in the past, but apparently we're going to let it go by this time if we like the text. We're going to be looking at the Middle East and at that Saddam Hussein's move to send hostages home and how that changes things for Secretary of State Baker, what it's likely to make the American people feel about the situation. We're also going to look at the SNL question and see if we can puzzle out something about the Keating hearings and how we got to where we are.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Marie Burke has three sons. All three of her sons belong to a combat unit of the National Guard that's now training at Fort Stewart, Georgia, and may be sent to the Gulf. We called Marie Burke at her home in Calhoun, Georgia, a rural town of about 6,000, where Burke is a high school guidance counselor. I asked her if there was any regulation that could prevent having all three sons on active duty in the same unit.
We asked about that, and they said because it's not a war, that it doesn't apply. But they also told us that if it comes to sending him to Saudi Arabia, they would send one, and that would probably be the oldest because he's a tank commander. Another one could volunteer to go, and that the third one would be transferred to a company that was not on deployed to the war area.
Why did they enlist in the National Guard?
The two older boys enlisted in the National Guard because it was the way they both earned Georgia National Guard scholarships, which allowed them to attend college on a full ride at North Georgia College, which is the military college in Georgia.
Mm-hmm. So they enlisted in the Guard primarily to get through college.
Right. And then the youngest one joined the Guard because the older boys were in it, and it provided him with some direction in his life and with some specific training, because he went this past summer for 14 weeks of his advanced training as a welder.
If you had known when they signed up for the National Guard that this might have happened, what would you have said to them?
To consider it carefully. I'm from a large family, and the military throughout years has been the way that my brothers and different ones have been able to make their lives better as a result of the training they get, but that they need to understand that the bottom line is that it is a military commitment. I wouldn't have told them not to do it.
Are you spending your day any differently than you did before your sons were put on active duty?
Not much. I maybe keep a little busier, because if you keep busy doing what you're doing, that you don't have so much time to think about what might be. And my husband and I both work real hard at trying to deal with today. Today they're okay. Today they're in Fort Stewart. You know, we'll deal with tomorrow. There's no point in worrying about what might happen 4 months from now.
What kind of work does your husband do?
He's a farmer. And so in a lot of ways, it's harder on him than it is on me, because I can stay busy here, and he has to work, you know, where he is at home. He has to busy himself on his own rather than having other people making demands from him.
Having three sons called up in the reserves now, mm-hmm. Is that making you feel more patriotic or more skeptical?
I don't think it's more skeptical. I'm proud of them, and I guess patriotic, but not necessarily more patriotic. I know that my children, you know, are precious to me, and it's kind of unique to have three sons in the same unit. But I also feel for those people. I work with a lady whose only son is gone, and she's giving just as much with having one son there as I am with having three. You know, you can't give any more than all you've got.
Right. Well, I wish you and your sons the best, and I thank
you very
much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Marie Burke spoke with us from Calhoun, Georgia. Our interviews today were produced by Ed Doherty, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with production assistance from Joan Tuohy and Roberta Shurrock. Chris Spurgeon is our director, Danny Miller our senior producer. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet French filmmaker Diane Curis. She made the movie Entre Nous and the new semi-autobiographical film C'est la vie, about a girl whose parents are divorcing. Also, TV critic David Bianculli reviews a new special on Frank Baum, the writer who created The Wizard of Oz. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.